May it please the court. This is a case where the trial court declared the criminal non-support statute in Missouri unconstitutional in a ruling which flied in the face of this court's ruling in Holmes about statutory interpretation, which defied the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Dixon versus United States as to whether or not it is constitutionally impermissible to have a mental state of knowing violation and require affirmative defenses to be proved by the defendant, and which usurped the legislature's core constitutional function of defining what an element of a criminal offense is in the state of Missouri.
The problem we had, the brilliant decision, the brilliant opinion in Holmes' case, I might add, was excellent and very informative. But the problem we still have, whether you make it the affirmative defense or an element, it's an interesting question of, can the prosecutor prove the negative? Can they prove, if you make it, if you say, well, you can't put the burden on the defendant to have to prove they had good cause, it's an element of the crime. And so how's the prosecutor supposed to prove there's no good cause, although the statute was changed, how's the prosecutor supposed to prove there is no good cause if they don't have that evidence, if it's not put on the defendant to prove that?
I agree, Judge. I think that's the policy judgment that was ultimately made by the legislature. And that's consistent with a long line of cases by the U.S. Supreme Court and others which hold that where there is an informational asymmetry, as they call it in Dixon, that the burden of proof may be assigned to the defendant in a genuine affirmative defense as opposed to something which negates no.
But it falls on the legislature, but we still have that tricky thing called the Constitution.
Sure.
Where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. The prosecutor has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a criminal case. So how the putting that then on the defendant to do the affirmative defense, say, well, I didn't pay it because I was unemployed, or what other reason they might have.
And that's precisely the claim that was adjudicated by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dixon versus United States case in 2006. In that case, they held that the definition of the elements of the criminal offense is entrusted to the legislature. They specifically dealt with a statute which had two mental states depending on which violation was alleged, one of which was knowingly, which is the same mental state as in this statute. And the court held, quote, it is these specific mental states rather than some vague evil mind or criminal intent that the government is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Going more basically to the policy issue Judge Teitelman was asking about, I think the question goes to, is there a burden on the state to show, is there constitutionally, the statute does not impose a burden on the state to show good cause. Does the Constitution require it to do so as to child support, or is the fact that that child support is sort of separated out from other debts and is not considered imprisonment for debt if you go to jail for failure to pay child support, does that distinguish it and take away from the state its obligation to prove ability to pay?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And there are actually two cases which are not within this jurisdiction, but which have specifically addressed similar issues, one of which I handed a copy up to my colleague this morning, which I will send you a letter about. It's called Davis versus Barber, which was decided by the Seventh Circuit.
Copy to your opposing party, too, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And she's already has one that I handed to her this morning. That was a Seventh Circuit case in which they dealt with a statute that was remarkably similar to the one that we have here, where it required the state to prove that they had knowingly failed to support, and they held that it was inability to pay was a defense. And the court specifically held that that did not violate the Due Process Clause because it was not a negation of an element, but rather requiring the defendant to prove as an affirmative defense some material that was outside the elements of the statute. The second one is State versus Lakine, which I cite in the brief, which was a Michigan State Supreme Court case in 2012, which dealt with a statute that was far more restrictive than ours. That one was admittedly, according to the Michigan Supreme Court, a strict liability statute, which held that if you didn't pay a court-ordered support order, then you were criminally liable. And the only defense that there were inability to pay was not a defense. The only defense that existed there was the common law defense of genuine impossibility. And the court held that that survived due process analysis.
Address your opponent's argument that that there's presumed liability to provide support in order to determine criminal intent. And so the ability to provide support remains an element of the crime, and therefore you are shifting the burden by requiring the defendant to prove that when it's presumed one of the elements of the case?
I don't know why it would be presumed one of the elements of the case. This court specifically held it's not an element of the case in Holmes. You said, had the legislature wished to remove without good cause as an element but allowed it as an affirmative defense, it could have removed the phrase without good cause from paragraph 1 and added it to paragraph 3. And then you said, indeed, that is just what it did when it adopted these amendments.
So you're citing Holmes?
Yes. And that's at page 814 of the Holmes decision. So you've already held it's no longer an element of the crime.
Can you address, opposing counsel argues it is because good cause or lack of good cause goes to mens rea. And if I understand it, your argument is that's an entirely separate concept, that the statute has its own mens rea, which is knowingly, not intentionally. And for knowingly, you don't need to show lack of good cause.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The statute says knowingly fails to provide adequate support, which such parent is legally obligated to provide for her child or stepchild who is not otherwise emancipated. So the mens rea is knowingly. Dixon specifically says that where the mens rea is knowingly, it is constitutionally acceptable not to require some vague showing of criminal intent, as they used to do under the old ideas of what mental states were.
What's the burden of proof on the defendant on the affirmative defense of not being able to pay?
Paragraph 3 says, inability to provide support for good cause shall be an affirmative defense. A person who raises such affirmative defense has the burden of proving the defense by a preponderance of the evidence. So it's their burden by the preponderance.
And does the prosecutor then have the burden of, beyond a reasonable doubt, to say that it wasn't when they come back and say that's not correct? Does the prosecutor have the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that is that the defense isn't well taken?
No, Your Honor, because it's not a special negative defense. If it were a special negative defense, then the burden would be on the prosecution. But because it is a true affirmative defense, it's
the way the statute is currently written, it wouldn't require the prosecutor to put on any additional evidence relative to that offense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I apologize for my faulty memory, but from my days presiding over child enforcement cases, there's a case out of this court in 1976, I believe, that does not allow a person or who fails to pay child support to be incarcerated for contempt without a showing that they have an ability to pay. And this court has subsequently, I think, required that you can't jail someone for contempt for failure to pay child support. And Judge, this question triggered this because she's asking, is there a distinction on child support? And I think there is, but there was a limitation that you couldn't, at the time you found them in contempt, you couldn't make the determination of ability to pay then. You had to do it right before you were putting them in jail so that they held the key to the courthouse or to the jail. So if in a civil proceeding you cannot incarcerate unless there is proof they have an ability to pay, how can we get around that in a criminal statute and say you can incarcerate them for a crime when they may not have an ability to pay?
Well, I think the United States Supreme Court specifically addressed that very issue in Hicks versus Fiock, which is the case that defense bar has relied on in a previous case in which they cite here. In Hicks, the U.S. Supreme Court was confronted with the question of whether a California statute, a person was jailed for contempt for failing to pay child support. The U.S. Supreme Court said that whether or not it was an element of the crime was the key to whether or not it was a constitutional violation. And they deferred to the California Supreme Court.
I thought that case dealt with a quasi-criminal matter.
Yeah, and that was the statute was goofy, and they ended up remanding it to determine whether it's criminal or civil, because they thought it mattered.
And is there a higher standard for criminal than there is for quasi-criminal?
If it's an element of the crime. And the crucial part of Hicks is that they deferred to the California court's determination that ability to pay was an element of the crime in that case.
So your point is that in contempt, intent is the mens rea, and ability to pay is part of it, but here it simply requires a knowing violation that you don't need to show ability to pay.
And in Hicks, the California court did find that the ability to pay was an element of the offense.
Yes, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court made it crystal clear that they were relying on that state determination. Had the state determination of what was an element been different, that would not necessarily have been their whole.
How much different was their statute than ours? Do you know?
Well, that dealt with a contempt statute as opposed to the actual child support statute. So the actual child support statute was not at issue there.
And what was the contempt statute?
Well, the court was confused about whether it was talking about their criminal contempt or their civil contempt, and they asked, they were remanded so the court could determine which statute we're dealing with.
Even in the contempt scenario, is it on the person who owes the obligation to demonstrate that they don't have the ability to pay? There's nothing unconstitutional about either in the criminal setting or in the contempt setting to put the burden on the person who has the obligation to demonstrate that they don't have the ability to pay, correct?
As far as I know, as long as it's not an element of the crime. I mean, I think the problem with contempt is where courts have held it's an element of the crime, that's when you get into trouble. It's not an element of the crime.
But if they said it constitutionally has to be an element, or it's just however the statute it happens to be written,
I think it's how the statute is written. Okay. And the court has repeatedly said this. In Dixon, the court was dealing with a defense of duress. It was a federal firearms violation. And basically the guy was saying, hey, I had good cause for this firearms violation because I was under duress. And the court held it was not unconstitutional, since the facts were within the knowledge of the party, to require that defendant to prove that defense. And the same was true in Smith versus United States, which dealt with withdrawal from a criminal conspiracy. The court emphasized the informational asymmetry and said that traditionally, dating all the way back to English common law, affirmative defenses had been required to be proven by the defense, particularly where there was an informational asymmetry. And this was one of those cases, and it was not unconstitutional. And then, as I said, in Patterson versus New York, in 77, they more generally, which was a case after the one that she cited, by the way, in her letter brief, Mullane, they said that proof of the existence of affirmative defenses has never been constitutionally required to be imposed upon the state. So I think that answers the question of whether or not it's unconstitutional to require the state to require the defendant to prove something that is not an element of the crime. Now, she wants to infer somehow that criminal intent is the element rather than knowingly. And the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with that in Dixon very specifically. And they discussed.
I'm sorry, your time's up. So
oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Yes, you're right. I'm sorry.
If it's blinking, it's up.
There's a number, but it's going up rather than down. I'm sorry. Thank you.
You have time for rebuttal.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal on that issue.
So in some ways, isn't the legislature giving the defendant in the legislation the right to prove to assert their defense, as opposed to, let's say, a criminal, someone gets killed and a person asserts self-defense, they have to make that own their own assertion, but it's always on the defendant to make that assertion and prove self-defense. In this case, the legislature says you have a right to show you can't pay.
Well, I think what concerned the trial court here and the reason he struck down the statute, the reason the trial court felt that this was a non-constitutional statute is because it applies to every parent who knows that they're not providing support. It's not addressed to the recalcitrant parent, which is where the requirement of ability to pay comes in and which has always been required. And in fact, the legislature, when it removed without good cause from the elements section, continued the comments section, which refers to the recalcitrant parent. There's no evidence that the legislature was trying to create this strict liability where
well,
it has never been.
Well, the evidence is their change of the statute. Lack of good cause used to be an element. They specifically took it out, left in the word knowingly, didn't make it intentionally. We look at what the legislature intended by what they said, don't we? And what they took out, the change in the statute.
Well, Your Honor, without good cause or an ability to pay, then it's essentially no longer a crime because a crime.
But knowingly is a level of criminal intent, which many of our criminal statutes use.
Okay, but a crime requires two elements, an actus reus and a mens rea. The wrongful act here is failing to provide adequate support. The guilty mind, though, is just knowing that you're not providing adequate support.
I understand, but your argument would invalidate lots and lots of statutes that only require knowingly. And our statutes specifically say there's knowingly, purposefully, intentionally, and all those are levels of criminal intent that have varying degrees of sanction as a result. I understand that you think it's a policy matter or maybe as a constitutional matter, and I want to hear your arguments. It has to be higher than knowingly, but if you said knowingly could not be a basis for criminal conviction, then lots of our criminal statutes would have to be rewritten, wouldn't they?
Well, the issue of ability to support bears directly on the criminality of the conduct. So if you say that you don't have to show that there's an ability to support, then the act itself is not criminal.
But why not? The statute makes it criminal.
Well,
It's not criminal if the statute says what opposing counsel says. Your argument must be that it shouldn't be allowed to, or that it's unconstitutional for it to do it, or there's some reason why we can't interpret it that way.
Well, the legislature has shifted the burden to the defendant by putting it in an exception clause, which is subsection 3. And so the defendant is now required to show that the presence of good cause negates the statutory element.
It's not being a negation of the element. It's simply an affirmative defense, like self-defense doesn't mean you didn't kill the person or assault the person or whatever it may be, but it simply makes you not liable under the law, right?
Well, I filed a letter brief yesterday with the court that talks about a case where, and it was State versus Commonals out of this court in
1970.
Correct. And the facts were, the defendant was charged with a stealing offense. And it was, the statute was that it defined what property was and it defined what stealing was, and it said it shall be unlawful for any person to intentionally steal the property of another without consent. But then there was an exception clause in subsection 3 that said if the property stolen within the meaning of subsection 2, so within the crime itself, was a chattel, then the person charged with stealing it can prove by a preponderance of the evidence that no further transfer was made and he intended to merely use it and then return it, then he could prove that he was not guilty.
But how does proving that you had good cause negate knowing? You still knew you weren't paying the child support, and that's what the statute says is sufficient to find you guilty of failure to pay child support, and whether you knowingly did it without good cause. We're not talking about a policy issue. That's a good policy that the legislature made it an affirmative defense instead of part of the state's burden. But if they used to require proof of knowledge plus lack of good cause and they got rid of lack of good cause, they still left knowledge. How does your proving good cause negate the knowledge element?
Well, it shifts the burden to the defendant to prove that he didn't have an ability to pay. So
yeah.
if you know, basically if you take all of that out, what you're saying is that it's strict liability. And the legislature,
couldn't there be a situation where somebody doesn't know that there's a support order out there? I mean, it's possible that there could have been an administrative order or a support order that a parent doesn't know about.
That would negate the knowingly.
Right.
But that would require the defendant to prove that. That would place.
No, it wouldn't, because the state would have to prove that he knew about the order.
Well, you don't have to have an order to be obligated to support your children, but you might not know they needed support, and so you wouldn't otherwise.
Well, this court held in McLarty that the existence of criminal intent is essential even when it's not in terms required by the statute. And before a statute will be construed as to eliminate guilty knowledge or intent as an element of the offense, then the legislative intent must be clearly apparent.
And I'm sorry to keep saying it, but they did that when they said knowingly. And I think your argument is that knowingly is not high enough. and that there's something wrong with imposing liability solely based on acting knowingly, that you have to have a higher burden. And
what the knowingly goes to is a failure to pay. And so that's why...
Failure to support.
Failure to adequately support. So that's why I believe it has to be read in conjunction with Section 562.011, which requires a voluntary act. The criminal responsibility or criminal liability that is premised on an omission to act has to be voluntary, which means you have to have the ability to perform that act, which is why I think this court needs to read into this section requiring knowingly that it requires an ability to perform the act in order to knowingly fail to provide
adequate
support.
So you're saying it's a presumed element.
It's a presumed element.
But your opponent says that Holmes answers that and says it's not.
Well, Holmes never answered the question. I mean, in Holmes, this court said that it was an element. Without good cause was an element, and it wasn't addressing whether or not the constitutionality of if the legislature removed that, which it knew at the time of Holmes that it had removed it. It wasn't addressing the constitutionality of that act.
562.011 says that you have to have the physical ability, doesn't it?
Correct.
Not the financial ability or... the solvency, but the physical ability. Are you saying your client did not have the physical ability to pay?
Correct. Well, there's been no proof adduced, but he's charged with failing to provide $700 worth of support. He's unemployed, and he qualifies for public defender services. So he does not have the ability to support.
Is that a physical inability under the meaning of that statute 011?
Well, I'm not sure what physical ability would require, but I think turning over support to your children or to the spouse or whoever, it requires a physical act of which he cannot perform because he has no money to turn over or not the adequate support that's required. So I think that makes this case different when it's premised upon an omission to act. The knowingly has to... require an ability to pay.
Did you allege a constitutional violation in making criminal liability depend on acting knowingly without also requiring an intent not to support or an ability not to support?
That was the basis of the motion to dismiss, that without requiring an ability to pay or to show without the state showing without good cause, then it swoops up every parent who knowingly doesn't provide support.
Right, and if that violates what constitutional provision?
Due process, because the state has to prove all the elements of the crime, and here you're shifting that burden to the defendant to show that he's...
But isn't that circular? Why is it an element? I understand all your good arguments why it should be an element that you're making, but the legislature had both knowingly and good cause before and took one out, and you're saying you must assume they still meant good cause was part of knowingly.
Well, I think adequate support encompasses the ability to pay. And if you can negate that, if you can negate the knowing by showing good cause, then you're requiring the defendant to negate an element of the offense. The only way to negate knowingly is to show good cause. And so...
Isn't it possible that there could be a father who does not know that he has a child?
Yes, I mean that's a possibility. But I'm, in terms of the ability to pay, I don't think that goes to an ability to pay, or the ability to provide adequate support. I mean, the legislature has to have a criminal intent. I'm not sure. Knowingly failing to pay is not a criminal. Or knowingly failing to provide adequate support isn't criminal.
Well, the statute says it is.
Well, but it's just a knowledge that you're not paying. It's not a... It's not
the
criminality.
A misdemeanor speeding charge is you're is strict liability, that you are driving over the speed limit.
Right, but for a statute to be interpreted as strict liability, it has to be clearly apparent that that's what the legislature intended.
Why isn't it from the use of the word knowing?
The legislature still refers in the comments section to the recalcitrant parent. They're going after the recalcitrant parent. At the time these statutes were passed, they also created non-support courts, the ability of counties to do non-support courts, which assumed that there were lots of parents out there that were being charged that actually didn't have the ability to pay, and let's put them into a court system where we can give them work on vocational training, educational opportunities, mm-hmm. so that they can then have the ability.
By changing it from an element of the crime to an affirmative defense, it would appear the legislature was recognizing that the parent has the evidence to present as to whether or not they have the ability to pay, rather than the state having that information. Is that a legitimate reason why if it's not listed as an element, that it is more appropriately an affirmative defense?
No, this court has held for decades that it's not an unacceptable burden in non-support cases, that the burden lays with the state.
Well, that's when the
element,
when the statute required it.
Right, so I don't know why we presume that the legislature would have thought that it's easier for the defendant to prove it than for the state, when that has never been the case. Any case that has come before this court...
Well, of course it's easier. I mean, you know your own financial situation better than a stranger to it does. I mean, as a matter of common sense, that doesn't really... But clearly before the legislature thought the state nonetheless could do it, but now they're putting it on the defense to do it.
Well, what I think they've done is they've called it an affirmative defense, but what it actually is a special negative defense, because a special negative defense under the statute presents a positive set of circumstances which, if found, would negate one or more of the essential elements of an offense, or which would constitute a legal defense. And so what they're saying is, yes, the defendant has evidence, and the defendant has always been required to inject the issue, and that's not a question. And on a special negative defense, you still have to inject the issue, but you can't force the defendant to then bear the burden. So once it's been injected, the state then needs to prove that they do have the ability to pay, and there's several reasons why the state is able to do that. They could show that they haven't sought a court order to reduce the child support amount. They could call the...
Well, child support amounts, as Holmes and Clayton say, are simply evidence of the need to support. Whether or not there's a child support order and whatever amount it is not determinative of what you need to pay to provide adequate
support.
Right,
but it's presumptive. It would be enough to meet the burden, is what Holmes
right.
found. I see my time's up.
Thank you.
Now, referring back to Judge Wilson's excellent question, what's the difference between physically being able to pay and financially being able to pay? You're the state of Missouri. Tell me the distinction.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Voluntary Act statute she cites doesn't mean remotely this kind of circumstance. A Voluntary Act is defined as a bodily movement performed while conscious as a result of effort or determination. That deals with cases like a driver who is passed out and is unconscious and crashes into somebody cannot be held criminally liable. Maybe in a case like this, if the defendant was in a coma, you wouldn't have the Voluntary Act. But it's very narrowly defined. And there's an exception in paragraph 4 of that statute which says a person's not guilty of an offense based solely upon an omission to perform an act unless the law defining the offense expressly so provides, or a duty to perform the omitted act is otherwise imposed by law. And you have both of those things here. The definition of the statute is failure to provide support, and the duty to support your children is provided in the statute. So the Voluntary Act statute does not remotely apply to these circumstances. The 1970 case she talks about is, and I listened very carefully, the mens rea in that statute was intentionally, and that was why it was the burden was on the state, because it was a different mens rea. She talks about whether or not it's high enough to require knowing, and as Judge Smith observes, her argument is essentially that that's not a high enough culpable mental state. That point was specifically addressed in the case she cites, which is State versus Logan, at page 65, where it said that the code requires a culpable mental state for all crimes, but that the MACR second's requirement of knowledge certainly complies with the code, it says. So knowingly is an acceptable mental state under that particular statute. And indeed, this court has held that far less than that is sufficient to pass constitutional muster, as far back as 1983 in State versus Beshear, when you said, generally speaking, it is within the power of the legislature to declare an act criminal irrespective of the intent or knowledge of the doer. Due process is not violated by the fact that a person is punished for an act in violation of the law, although ignorant of the facts making it so. So you could have a lot lower mental states, such as criminal negligence, and that would be sufficient. You did address recently the whole point of informational asymmetry, I think, in the Claycomb case, which was the last child support case we did up here, when you held that it was not a burden on the state to negate the possibility that the defendant had provided in-kind support in an amount constituting adequate support for the child. Certainly there's an informational asymmetry here. The legislature has recognized over the years that that has become a very difficult burden, and that there's an appalling amount of child support that isn't being paid. And it was certainly within their prerogative to redefine the burdens in such a way that the informational asymmetry is recognized and that it comports with the due process clause of the Constitution. This court has held that the duty to support your children is the most fundamental burden that a person assumes as a member of society, and that that premise was honored in the statute, and therefore the decision of the trial court should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.